Tony had been waiting for the rain. It had come on all at once, a lowering bank of cloud, a few drops, and then a downpour. But even before the skies had really opened, he had zipped up his jacket, donned his backpack, and clambered out of his hiding place beneath the totara to run and crawl and slip and slide his way out of the Kodawai Basin, zigzagging through the bush, hand clapped over the precious roll of film in his pocket, pack jouncing on his shoulders, listening out for a siren or a shout of warning or a gunshot or the now unmistakable sound of a drone. But none came. He kept running for hours, knees and ankles screaming, breath spiking in his lungs, back to the track along the ridge, past the cairn he'd built above the farm, cloud filling the valleys to his left and right. The rain began to ease, and then finally stopped altogether as he was descending into Thorndike. He set his jaw and ran faster, determined not to stop until he'd reached the visitor center car park where he had left Veronica's car. Tony had breached the fence in Kodawai 2 days ago. He couldn't put a name to most of what he'd found there, but he knew environmental devastation when he saw it. He could recognize the signs of toxic, rapacious, unconscionable, imperial stage capitalist industrial disgrace. He had taken photographs of everything. The vast sheets of camouflage-style netting spread over the ground, which could surely have no scientific purpose other than concealment, and which he'd lifted up to see dozens, maybe hundreds, of manhole covers sunk into the ground in a massive grid. And beyond them, also concealed and camouflaged, piles of PVC piping, coiled hoses, empty drums, heaps of rubble, and a tractor-sized piece of equipment he couldn't identify. Some kind of pump, perhaps. Its flank was studded with valves and dials, like the side of a fire engine. Everywhere the plants were dead or dying, trees wilting, dead ferns with black and withered leaves, dead branches dusted white, husks of dead insects crunching underfoot, even dead birds, riflemen, wax eyes, fantails, a kereru. Some still plump and glassy, others desiccated and flattened with decay. He had moved swiftly, not wanting to stay a moment longer than he needed to. And when he'd used up his roll of film, the last thing he did before he left the area was to try to shift one of the manhole covers aside so that he could see what lay beneath it. It was very heavy, but when he braced himself, it moved. He slid it aside and saw a cylindrical borehole, a little under a meter in diameter, drilled into the bedrock. How deep, Tony didn't know, for the hole was filled to the brim with an evil-smelling chemical solution that had made his stomach rise into his throat. He'd replaced the cover almost at once, but the smell had lingered. It was a toxic, malignant stink, and he had felt it not just in his nose and in his lungs, but in his veins and in his gut and in his fingertips. He recalled it now as he fumbled, weak with exhaustion, for the keys to Veronica's car, and clattered to unlock the door, feeling a wave of nausea and the stinging onset of a headache. He got into the driver's seat and shut the door, but he could still smell it. He put the key in the ignition and cracked the window to refresh the air. Then he sat shivering, still soaking wet, still breathing hard, his pulse still throbbing in his neck. The government's proposal had not been scrapped at all. They hadn't caved in the face of public pressure. They hadn't respected peaceful protest. They hadn't capitulated to the public mood. They had simply begun mining the country's national parks in secret, against the will of the people, without the knowledge of the people. Illegally, immorally, without environmental oversight or oversight of any kind. And, given the Autonomo connection, in collusion with a foreign company to boot. It was a theft of historic proportions. It was conspiracy and corruption at the highest level. It was an offense against democracy. It was the gravest conspiracy, the most shocking lie, the most egregious rape of nature and abuse of power in the entire history of his country. It was treason. Treason, Tony repeated dumbly in his mind, thinking how antique and even fanciful it seemed. He was so staggered that he started to laugh, but his laughter subsided almost at once. And in its place, he felt a wave of fury and despair roll over him at the sheer inexorability of late capitalist degradation, not just of the environment, not just of civic institutions, not just of intellectual and political ideals, but worse, of his own expectations. Of what he even felt was possible anymore. A familiar surge of grief and helpless rage at the reckless, wasteful, soulless, narcissistic, barren selfishness of the present day. and at his own political irrelevance and impotence, and at the utter shamelessness with which his natural inheritance, his future, had been either sold or laid to waste by his parents' generation, trapping him in a perpetual adolescence that was further heightened by the infantilizing unreality of the internet as it encroached upon and colonized real life. Real life, Tony thought, with bitter air quotes, for late capitalism would admit nothing real beyond the logic of late capitalism itself, having declared self-interest the only universal and profit motive the only absolute, and deriding everything that did not serve its ends as either a contemptible weakness or a fantasy. Then that subsided too, and he was left trembling, heart pounding, chest brimming with a feeling that was very like euphoria. Aloud he said, "Jesus Christ." And then again, "Jesus Christ." And then, hushed in wonderment, he said, "I'm going to be so fucking famous." Wanting suddenly to put some distance between himself and Thorndyke, he put his seatbelt on and turned the key to start the engine. The nearest town was about an hour's drive away. He'd treat himself to a night in a motel, he thought, somewhere with a stable internet connection, where he could have a hot shower, get his thoughts together, and plan what he was going to do next. His laptop was under the passenger seat beside him. He reached down a hand to check. Still there. And his phone was in the bottom of his backpack, not only powered off, as it had been all week, but wrapped in the foil emergency blanket that he'd carried with him on every tramping trip since adolescence, and, until now, had never had a reason to use. That was probably overkill, especially since the photos he had taken weren't digital, so weren't thievable or trackable, and weren't even visible yet to anyone but him. But he knew he wouldn't be able to rest until he'd got them back underdeveloped from the lab. No, until he'd got them back, and they'd been copied, and the duplicates had been secured, and his article was written, and he'd sent it off to multiple publications in multiple countries. The Guardian, the Süddeutsche Zeitung, the New York Times. He wouldn't be able to rest, he told himself, until his byline was on front pages all around the world. He put his indicator on and looked over his shoulder to pull out onto the highway when something thumped hard against the bonnet of his car. Tony whipped around and saw that the guy from the chip shop was standing by his left headlight, grinning stupidly and waving at him.
"You a journalist yet?" he said.
Tony stared at him.
"You told me to ask you,"
the guy said, strolling round to the driver's window.
"You said, next time you see me, ask me again. And I'm seeing you, so..."
"Oh," Tony said. "Yeah." Almost as a reflex, wanting an outlet for his nervous energy perhaps, he shut off the engine and pulled the handbrake up hard, and then sat gripping the steering wheel with both hands, as if the guy were a policeman and had pulled him over in a traffic stop.
"So," said the guy, "are you?"
And in the second of silence before he answered, Tony heard it again, a distant roaring noise, almost like the sound inside a seashell, a putter curving up into a whine.
"Could you do me a favor?" he said to the guy. "Could you look up and see if there's a drone overhead?" "Right now," said the guy.
But he was already craning his head back, turning in a circle, scanning the sky. Then he stopped and pointed up.
"Hey," he said. "Yeah, look at that. Oh, now it's flying away."
He turned back to Tony, grinning now.
"That was cool. Whose is it?"
Tony's guts felt like they'd turned to water. He released the handbrake, turned the engine on again, and put his finger on the button to shut the driver's window.
"I'm pretty sure that it belongs to someone from the government," he said,
trying to keep his voice normal.
"And the answer to your question earlier is yes."
Speeding out of Thorndyke, hunching over the wheel to be able to see as much of the sky through the windscreen as he possibly could, he was reminded of an old story that his mother liked to tell, about the first time she'd had Tony's grandparents over for dinner as a newlywed. She'd been anxious to make a good impression, and when she'd gone into the kitchen to dish out the first course, she'd discovered, to her dismay, that the soup had curdled on the stove. She'd grabbed a sieve to strain it, and in her panic, she'd put the sieve into the sink and dumped the contents of the pot into it, only to realize her mistake. The soup, of course, had gone down the drain, and she'd retained only the lumps. Tony had heard the story so many times it was as if the memory had become his own, and although the story had a punchline, something caustic that Tony's grandmother had said, he never remembered it. The detail that captured him was the lumps in the sieve and the soup running down the drain,
and his mother's horror as she realized that she had rescued the wrong part of the meal. Mira didn't know. That was the thought that resounded in his head as the road unspooled past the tip of the lake, and down through the foothills and on towards the plains, over one-lane bridges, through stone cuttings and over crossings of abandoned railway lines, into sudden shadows and then out again. Mira didn't know. None of them did. Tony was sure of it. He'd have been sure even if he hadn't watched them working through his binoculars from the ridge. Even if he hadn't gone to the Hui and heard Mira describe Lemoyne's offer with such naked excitement and desire. Mira may have sold her soul, but at least she had the soul to offer up, Tony thought. She didn't know what was happening in Kodawai. She couldn't. Mira didn't know. He needed to pee, but he kept driving 5 minutes more, then 10, then 15, until he was desperate. At last, he couldn't wait any longer, and he pulled off the highway into a gravel lay-by that looked out over a ravine. Experimentally, he turned off the engine and cracked the window, listening hard, but he could hear nothing but birdsong and the wind in the trees. He got out of the car and shaded his eyes and looked up. The sky was a liquid cyan, high and clear after the rain, white clouds scudding in the north and in the west. He scanned the horizon until his eyes began to water, and then he relieved himself as quickly as he could and got back in the car. He checked the clock on the dashboard. He'd been driving for 45 minutes at an average of roughly 80 k's an hour. Say 60 kilometers then, maybe a little less, as the crow flew, as the drone flew, to account for the curves in the road. Call it 50. Could a drone fly that far, that fast? And how long could it go before refueling? Tony didn't know, but he felt fairly certain that he'd left the thing behind. He was about to resume his journey when two SUVs with dark tinted windows screamed past him in the opposite direction, heading for Thorndyke. Barely a second later, he heard the squeal of tires, and the second of the two vehicles reversed back past the lay-by at high speed and then careened sharply sideways to block the bridge over the ravine. The first wasn't far behind. It also reversed past Tony and made a screeching handbrake turn, scorching the tarmac and coming to a hard stop beside the other. Then nothing. They waited, engines idling, suspension trembling, tinted windows dark. Tony felt like he was going to be sick. They were boxing him in. The road back to Thorndyke was a dead end, if he could even get as far as Thorndyke. These were clearly highly skilled defensive drivers. They had been dispatched to find him. Perhaps they'd been dispatched to run him off the road. His phone was at the bottom of his backpack, though even if he could get it out and turn it on, he might not get a signal. And even then, help would take some time to reach him. He'd seen nobody at all in the last 45 minutes. No other drivers, no farmers, no cyclists, no road workers. No witnesses, he thought, and felt even sicker. He looked to his left. There was a low guardrail around the edge of the lay-by, and beyond it, a gravel slope that led steeply down to the ravine. Downstream, the creek fanned out into stony shallows, and the hills beyond were densely forested and native bush. If he left the car, skidded down to the edge of the cliff and jumped, he could swim with the current, under the bridge and into the trees. He'd have a head start, and they probably wouldn't be expecting him to leave the car, much less throw himself into the water. Could he chance it? Tony glanced at his backpack on the seat beside him, and then again at the SUVs. Carefully, he released his seatbelt, trying to move as slowly and unobtrusively as possible, and ignoring the pulsing red light on the dash that told him to buckle up again. He turned the key in the ignition, put the car into first, and then drove right up to the guardrail, making a neat curve in the gravel as though he were preparing to execute a three-point turn to return to Thorndyke. He heard their engines rev slightly in response. He put the car into reverse and completed the second point of the turn. Now he was facing back the way he'd come, still in the lay-by, but on the wrong side of the road. The driver's door was right next to the guardrail. He felt strangely calm. The SUVs were nosing forward, ready to pursue. He could see nothing behind the tinted glass. Tony touched the roll of film in his pocket for luck. He counted to three under his breath. Then he grabbed his backpack and threw open the door. He didn't look back. He leapt over the guardrail and flung himself down the slope towards the water.